You're so much and just keep going as if nothing has happened. So many times I called you after Benton was killed and you would not find time for me. Why? Because you did not want to talk. I can't hide my emotions this time. Tears slide down my face and drop in my lap like blood. I have always told my patients when they do not face their problems, they are headed for a day of reckoning. Anna sits forward, intensely leaning into the words she fires straight at my heart. This is your day of reckoning. She points at me, staring. Now you will talk to me, Kay Scarpetta. I blearily look down at my lap. My slacks are speckled with tears, and I make the inane connection that the drops are perfectly round because they fell at a 90-degree angle. I can never get away from it, I say in despair under my breath. Get away from what? This has snagged Anna's interest. What I do. Everything reminds me of something from my work. I don't talk about it. I want you to talk about it now, she tells me. It's foolish. She waits, the patient fisherman, knowing I am nudging the hook. Then I take it. I give Anna examples I find embarrassing, if not ridiculous. I tell her I never drink tomato juice or V8 or Bloody Marys on the rocks, because when the ice begins to melt, it looks like coagulating blood separating from serum. I stopped eating liver in medical school, and the idea of considering any sort of organ as something for my palate is impossible. I recall a morning on Hilton Head Island when Benton and I were walking on the beach, and the receding surf had left areas of crinkled gray sand that looked remarkably like the lining of the stomach. My thoughts twist and turn where they will, and a trip to France unfolds for the first time in years. On the rare occasion when Benton and I ever really got away from our work, we toured the Grand Vin de Bourgogne and were received by the revered domains of Drouin and Dugas and tasted from casks of Chambertin, Montrachet, Mussigny, and Vogne Romanée. I remember being moved in ways I can't say. I share memories I did not know I still had. The light of early spring changing on the slopes, and the gnarled reach of cut-back winter vines, all holding up their hands in the same way, offering the best they have, their essence, to us. And so often we don't touch their character, don't take the time to find the harmony in subtle tones, the symphony fine wines play on your tongue if you let them. My voice drifts off. Anna silently waits for me to come back. Like my being asked only about my cases, I go on, only asked about the horrors I see, when there is so much else to me. I am not some goddamn cheap thrill with a screw cap. You feel lonely, Anna softly observes, and misunderstood, perhaps as dehumanized as your dead patients. I do not answer her, but continue my analogies, describing when Benton and I traveled by train across France for several weeks, ending in Bordeaux, and the rooftops got redder toward the south. The first touch of spring shimmered an unreal green on trees, and veins of water and the bigger arteries aspired toward the sea, just as all blood vessels in the body begin and end at the heart. I'm constantly struck by the symmetry in nature, the way creeks and tributaries from the air look like the circulatory system, and rocks remind me of old scattered bones, I say. And the brain starts out smooth and becomes convoluted and crevassed with time, much as mountains develop distinction over thousands of years. We are subjected to the same laws of physics, yet we aren't. The brain, for example, doesn't look like what it does. On gross examination, it's about as exciting as a mushroom. Anna is nodding. She asks if I shared any of these reflections with Benton. I say no. She wants to know why I didn't feel inclined to share what seemed like harmless perceptions with him, my lover. And I tell her I need to think about this for a minute. I'm not sure of the answer. No, she prods me. Do not think. Feel it. I ponder. No. Feel it, Kay. Feel it. She touches her hand over her heart. I have to think. I've gotten where I am in life by thinking, I reply defensively, snapping to, coming out of uncommon space I have just been in. I am back in her living room now and understand everything that has happened to me. You have gotten where you are in life by knowing, she says, and knowing is perceiving. Thinking is how we process what we perceive, and thinking often masks the truth. Why did you not wish to share your more poetic side with Benton? Because I don't really acknowledge that side. It's a useless side. To compare the brain to a mushroom in court would get you nowhere, for example, I reply. Ah, Anna nods again. You make analogies in court all the time. That is why you are such an effective witness. You evoke images so the common person can understand. Why did you not tell Benton the associations you are just now telling me? I stop rocking and reposition my fractured arm, resting the cast in my lap. I turn away from Anna and look out at the river, feeling suddenly evasive like Buford Ryder. Dozens of Canada geese have congregated around an old sycamore tree. They sit in the grass like dark, long-necked gourds and puff and flap and peck for food. I don't want to go through that looking glass, I tell her. It isn't just that I didn't want to tell Benton. I don't want to tell anyone. I don't want to tell it at all. And by not repeating involuntary images and associations, I don't... Well, I don't... Anna nods again, deeply this time. By not acknowledging them, you don't invite your imagination into your work, she finishes my thought. I have to be clinical, objective. You of all people should understand. She studies me before replying. Is that it? Or might it be that you are avoiding the unbearable suffering you most certainly would invite if you allowed your imagination to get involved in your cases? She leans closer, resting her elbows on her knees, gesturing. What if, for example, she pauses dramatically, you could take the facts of science and medicine and use your imagination to reconstruct in detail the last minutes of Diane Bray's life? What if you could conjure it up like the footage of a film and watch her being attacked, watch her hemorrhage, watch her being bitten and beaten, watch her die? That would be unspeakably awful, I barely reply. How powerful if a jury could see a film like that, she says. Nervous impulses boil beneath my skin like thousands of minnows. But if you went through that looking-glass, as you refer to it, she goes on, then where might it end? She throws her hands up. Ah, maybe it would not end, and you would be forced to watch the footage of Benton's murder. I shut my eyes. I resist her. No, please, Lord, don't make me see that. A flash of Benton in the dark, a gun trained on him, and the ratcheting sound, the snap of steel as they handcuff him. Taunts. They would taunt him. Mr. FBI, you're so smart. What are we going to do next, Mr. Profiler? Can you read our minds? Figure us out? Predict? Huh? He wouldn't answer them. He would ask them nothing as they forced him into a small neighborhood grocery store on the western fringes of the University of Pennsylvania that had closed at 5 in the afternoon. Benton was going to die. They would torment and torture him, and that was the part he would center on, how to short-circuit the pain and degradation he knew they would inflict if they had time. Darkness and the spurt of a match, his face wavering in the light of a small flame that trembles with each stir of air as those two psychopathic assholes move about in the plenum of a shitty little Pakistani grocery store they torched after he was dead. My eyelids fly open. Anna is talking to me. Cold sweat crawls down my sides like insects. I'm sorry. What did you say? Very, very painful. Her face melts with compassion. I cannot imagine. Benton walks into my mind. He wears his favorite khakis and his running shoes, Saucony running shoes. Sauconys were the only brand he would wear, and I used to call him a fuss budget, because he was so particular if he really liked something. And he has on the old UVA sweatshirt Lucy gave him, dark blue with bright orange letters, and over the years it has gotten very faded and soft. He cut off the sleeves because they were too short, and I've always liked how he looks in that old, worn-out sweatshirt, with his silver hair, his clean profile, the mysteries behind his intense, dark eyes. His hands lightly curl around the armrests of his chair. He has the fingers of a pianist, long and slender and expressive when he talks, and always gentle when they touch me, which is less and less with time. I'm saying all this out loud to Anna, speaking in the present tense about a man who has been dead for more than a year. "What secrets do you think he kept from you?" Anna asks. "What mysteries did you see in his eyes?" "Oh, God. Mostly about work." My breath trembles, my heart flying away in fear. "He kept many details to himself. Details about what he saw in certain cases. Things he felt were so awful no one else should be subjected to them."
"Even you?
Is there anything you have not seen?"
"Their pain." I speak quietly. "I don't have to see their terror. I don't have to hear their screams."
"But you reconstruct it."
"Not the same thing."
"No, not the same. Many of the killers Benton dealt with liked to photograph, audiotape, and in some instances videotape what they did to their victims. Benton had to watch. He had to listen. I always knew. He'd come home looking gray. He wouldn't talk much during dinner, wouldn't eat much, and on those nights he drank more than usual."
"But he wouldn't tell you..."
"Never," I interrupt with feeling. "Never. That was his Indian burial ground, and no one was allowed to step there. I taught at a death investigation school in St. Louis. This was early in my career, before I moved here, when I was still a deputy chief in Miami. I was doing a class on drowning and decided since I was already there I'd go ahead and attend the entire week-long school. One afternoon a forensic psychiatrist taught a class on sexual homicide. He showed slides of living victims. A woman was bound to a chair, and her assailant had tightly tied rope around one of her breasts and inserted needles in the nipple. I can still see her eyes. They were dark pools filled with hell, and her mouth wide open as she screamed. And I saw videotapes," I go on in a monotone. "A woman abducted, bound, tortured, and about to be shot in the head. She keeps whimpering for her mother, begging, crying. I think she was in a basement, the footage dark, grainy, the sound of the gun going off, and silence." Anna says nothing. The fire snaps and pops. "I was the only woman in a room of about 60 cops," I add.
"Even worse, then, because the victims were women and you were the only woman," Anna says.
Anger touches me as I remember the way some of the men stared at the slides, at the videotapes. "The sexual mutilation was arousing to some of them," I say. "I could see it in their faces, sense it. Same thing with some of the profilers, Benton's colleagues in the unit. They'd described the way Bundy would rape a woman from the rear as he strangled her. Eyes bulging, tongue protruding. He would climax as she died. And these men Benton worked with enjoyed the telling a bit too much. Do you have any idea what that's like?" I fix a stare on her that is as sharp as nails. "To see a dead body? To see photographs, videos of someone brutalized? Of someone suffering and terrified? And realize that the people around you are secretly enjoying it? That they find it sexy?"
"Do you think Benton found it sexy?" Anna asks.
"No. He witnessed such things weekly, maybe even daily. Sexy, never. He had to hear their screams." I have begun to ramble. "Had to hear them crying and begging. Those poor people didn't know. Even if they had, they couldn't have helped it."
"Didn't know? What didn't these poor people know?"
"That sexual sadists are only more aroused by crying, by begging, by fear," I reply.
"Do you think Benton cried or begged when his killers abducted him and took him to that dark building?"
Anna is about to score. "I've seen his autopsy report." I slip into my clinical hiding place. "There's really nothing in it to tell me definitively what happened before death. He was badly burned in the fire. So much tissue burned away, it wasn't possible to see, for example, if he still had a blood pressure when they cut him. "He had a gunshot wound to his head, too, did he not?" Anna asks.
"Yes."
"Which do you think came first?"
I stare mutely at her. I have not reconstructed what led up to his death. I have never been able to bring myself to do that.
"Envision it, Kay," Anna tells me. "You know, do you not? You have worked too many deaths not to know what happened." My mind is dark as the inside of that grocery store in Philadelphia.
"He did something, didn't he?"
She pushes, leaning into me, on the very edge of the ottoman.
"He won, didn't he?"
"Won!" I clear my throat.
"Won!"
I exclaim. "They cut his face off and burned him up, and you say he won?" She waits for me to make the connection. When I offer her nothing further, she gets up and walks to the fire, lightly touching my shoulder as she passes. She tosses on another log and looks at me and says,
"Kay, let me ask you, why would they shoot him after the fact?"
I rub my eyes and sigh. "Cutting off the face was part of the M.O., she goes on, "what Newton Joyce liked to do to his victims." She refers to the evil male partner of the evil Carrie Greffin, a psychopathic pair that made Bonnie and Clyde seem like a Saturday morning cartoon from my youth. "Excise their faces and store them in the freezer as souvenirs, and because Joyce's face was so homely, so scarred by acne," Anna goes on, "he stole what he envied. Beauty, yes?"
"Yes, I suppose. As much as we can go with any such theory about why people do what they do."
"And it was important that Joyce do the excisions carefully and not damage the faces, which is why he did not shoot his victims. Certainly not in the head. He did not want to risk causing damage to the face, the scalp.
And shooting is too easy."
Anna shrugs. "Quick, maybe merciful. Far better to be shot than to have your throat cut." "So why did Newton Joyce and Carrie Greffin shoot Benton?" Anna stands over me. I look up at her.
"He said something," I answer slowly, finally.
"He must have."
"Yes."
Anna sits back down.
"Yes, yes."
She encourages me with her hands, as if directing traffic to move across the next intersection.
"What? What? Tell me, Kay."
I reply that I don't know what Benton said to Newton Joyce and Carrie Greffin, but he said something or did something that caused one or the other to lose control of the game. It was an impulse, an involuntary reaction when one of them pushed the gun to Benton's head and pulled the trigger. Boom, and the fun was over. Benton felt nothing, was cognizant of nothing after that. No matter what they did to him after that, it didn't matter. He was dead or dying, unconscious. He never felt the knife. Maybe he never saw it.
"You knew Benton so well," Anna says. "You knew his killers, or at least you knew Carrie Greffin. You'd had experiences with her in the past. What do you think Benton said, and to whom did he say it? Who shot him?"
"I can't..."
"You can."
I look at her.
"Who lost control?"
She pushes me farther than I ever thought I could go.
"She did."
I pull this up from the deep. "Carrie did, because it was personal. She'd been around Benton from the old days, from the start, when she was at Quantico, at the engineering research facility, where she also met Lucy long years ago, maybe 10 years ago.
Yes, Benton knew her, knew Carrie, knew her probably as well as you can know any reptilian mind like hers," I add.
"What did he say to her?" Anna's eyes are riveted to me.
"Something about Lucy, probably," I say. "Something about Lucy that would insult Carrie. He insulted Carrie, taunted her about Lucy, that's what I believe."
I have a direct shunt from my subconscious to my tongue. I don't even have to think.
"Carrie and Lucy were lovers at Quantico," Anna adds another piece, "both working on the artificial intelligence computer in the engineering research facility.
Lucy was an intern, just a teenager, a kid, and Carrie seduced her. They were working on the computer system together. I got Lucy that internship, I bitterly add. I did. Me, her influential, powerful aunt.
Didn't lead to quite what you intended, did it? Anna suggests.
Carrie used her. Made Lucy gay?
No, I wouldn't go that far, I say. You don't make people gay.
Made Benton dead?
Can you go that far?
I don't know, Anna.
A volatile past? A personal history?
Yes.
Benton said something about Lucy, and Carrie lost control and shot him just like that.
Anna summarizes.
He did not die the way they planned.
She sounds triumphant.
He did not.
I rock quietly, looking out at a gray morning that has become full of bluster. The wind exerts itself in fierce gusts that fling dead branches and vines across Anna's backyard, reminding me of the angry tree hurling apples at Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz. Then Anna gets up with no announcement, as if an appointment is up. She leaves me to go about other business in her house. We have talked enough for now. I decide to retreat to the kitchen, and that is where Lucy finds me around noon after her workout. I'm opening a can of whole tomatoes when she walks in, the early stages of a marinara sauce simmering on the stove.
Need some help?
She looks at sweet onions, peppers, and mushrooms on the cutting board.
Kind of hard getting around with only one hand.
Pull up a stool, I tell her. You can be impressed with my fending for myself. I exaggerate bravado as I finish opening the can with no help, and she smiles as she moves a bar stool from the other side of the counter and sits. She is still in her running clothes and has a look in her eye, a secret light, reminding me of the river catching the sun very early in the morning. I steady an onion with two fingers of my immobilized left hand and began to slice.
Remember our game?
I lay the onion slices flat and begin to chop.
When you were 10?
Or can't you remember back that far?
I certainly will never forget,
I say, in a tone meant to remind Lucy what an impossible brat she was as a child. Bet you have no idea how many times I would have put you on admin leave, given the choice. I dare to push that painful truth. Maybe I am feeling bold because of my naked talk with Anna, which has left me unnerved and at the same time exhilarated.
I wasn't that bad.
Lucy's eyes dance because she loves to hear what a little terror she was when she was a child and would come stay with me. I drop handfuls of chopped sweet onions in the sauce and stir.
Truth serum.
Remember that game? I ask her. I'd come home, usually from work, and I could tell by the look on your face that you'd been up to something. So I'd sit you in that big red chair in the living room, remember? It was by the fireplace in my old house in Windsor Farms. And I'd bring you a glass of juice and tell you it was truth serum. And you'd drink it and confess.
Like the time I formatted your computer while you were gone.
She is laughing hard.
10 damn years old, and you format my hard drive.
I about had a heart attack, I recall.
Hey, but I did back up all your files first. I just wanted to give you a bad moment.
She is really enjoying this.
Well, I almost sent you home.
I wipe the fingertips of my left hand with a dish towel, careful that my cast doesn't smell like onions, as I experience a wave of sweet sadness. I don't really remember why Lucy came to stay with me on her first visit to Richmond, but I was not the child-rearing type, and was new in the job and under tremendous pressure. There was some sort of crisis with Dorothy. Maybe she ran off and got married again, or maybe I was a sucker. Lucy adored me, and I wasn't accustomed to being adored. Whenever I would visit her in Miami, she would follow me all over the house, everywhere I went, tenaciously moving with my feet like a soccer ball.
You weren't going to send me home.
Lucy is challenging me, but I catch the doubt in her eyes. The fear of not being wanted is based on fact in her life.
Only because I felt inadequate to take care of you, I reply, leaning against the sink.
Not because I wasn't crazy about you, little rat-fink that you were. She laughs again.
But no, I wouldn't have sent you home. Both of us would have been devastated.
I couldn't. I shake my head. Thank God for our little game. It was about the only way I could get to what was going on inside of you, or what mischief you had engaged in while I was off somewhere, at work, whatever. So, do I need to pour you juice or a glass of wine? Or are you going to just go on and tell me what's happening with you? I wasn't born yesterday, Lucy. You aren't staying in a hotel for the heck of it. You're up to something. I'm not the first woman they've run off, she starts in. You would be the best woman they've run off, I answer. Remember Tian McGovern? I'll remember her for the rest of my life. Tian, pronounced T-un, McGovern, was Lucy's ATF supervisor in Philadelphia, an extraordinary woman who was wonderful to me when Benton was killed. Please don't tell me something's happened to Tian, I worry. She quit about 6 months ago, Lucy replies. Seems ATF wanted her to move to L.A. and be the sack of that field division. The worst assignment on God's earth. Nobody wants L.A. A sack is a special agent in charge, and very few women in federal law enforcement end up running entire field divisions. Lucy goes on to tell me McGovern's answer was to resign and start a private investigative business of sorts. The last precinct, she says, getting more animated by the moment. Pretty cool name, right? Based in New York. Tian's rounding up arson investigators, bomb guys, cops, lawyers, all kinds of people to help out. And in less than 6 months, she's already got clients. It's sort of turned into a secret society. There's a real buzz on the street. When shit hits, call the last precinct. Where you go when there's nowhere left. I stir the simmering tomato sauce and taste a little. Obviously, you've been keeping up with Tian since you left Philadelphia. I drip in a few teaspoons of olive oil. Darn. I guess this will be all right, but not for the salad dressing. I hold up the bottle and frown. You press olive oil with the pits still in, it's like squeezing oranges with the rind still on, and you get what you deserve. Why is it I don't assume Anna is an aficionado of things Italian? Lucy dryly comments. We'll just have to educate her. Grocery list. I nod at a notepad and pen by the phone. First item, extra virgin olive oil, Italian integrate style, pitted before pressed. Mission Olive Supremo is a nice one if you can find it. Not a trace of bitterness. Lucy makes notes. Tian and I have stayed in touch, she informs me. You're somehow involved in what she's doing? I know this is where the conversation is headed. You could say that. Crushed garlic. In the refrigerated section in little jars. I'm going to be lazy. I pick up a bowl of lean ground beef that I have thoroughly cooked and patted free of grease. Not a good time for me to crush garlic myself. I stir the beef into the sauce. How involved? I go into the refrigerator and open drawers. Anna doesn't have fresh herbs, of course. Lucy sighs. God, Aunt Kay, I'm not sure you want to hear it. Until very recently, my niece and I have talked little and not in depth. We have seen each other seldom over the past year. She moved to Miami, and both of us retreated behind bunkers after Benton's death. I try to read the stories hiding in Lucy's eyes and instantly begin to entertain possibilities. I am suspicious about her relationship with McGovern, and was last year when all of us were called out to a catastrophic arson scene in Warrenton, Virginia, a homicide disguised by fire that turned out to be the first of several masterminded by Carrie Grethen. Fresh oregano, basil, and parsley. I dictate the grocery list. And a small wedge of Parmesan Reggiano. Lucy, just tell me the truth. I look for spices. McGovern is about my age and single. Or at least she was single last time I saw her. I shut a cupboard door and face my niece. Are you and Tian involved?
We weren't that way.
Weren't?
Actually, you're one to talk, Lucy says without rancor. What about you and Jay?
He doesn't work for me, I reply. I certainly don't work for him. I don't want to talk about him either. We're talking about you. I hate it when you dismiss me, Aunt Kay, she quietly says. I'm not dismissing you, I offer as an apology.
I just worry when people who work together get too personal. I believe in boundaries.
You worked with Benton. She points out another of my exceptions to my own rules.
I tap the spoon on the side of the pot.
I've done a lot of things in life that I tell you not to do. I tell you not to do them because I made the mistake first.
Did you ever moonlight?
Lucy stretches her lower back and rolls her shoulders.
I frown.
Moonlight? Not that I recall.
Okay. Truth serum time. I'm a felonious moonlighter and Tian's biggest backer. The major stockholder for the last precinct. There. The whole truth. You're going to hear it.
Let's go sit.
I direct us to the table and we pull out chairs.
It all began accidentally, Lucy begins. A couple years ago, I created a search engine for my own use. Meanwhile, all I was hearing about was the fortunes people were making on internet technology. So I said, what the hell, and sold the search engine for $750,000.
I am not shocked. Lucy's earning possibilities have been limited only by the profession she chose.
Then I get another idea when we seized a bunch of computers during a raid, she continues. I was helping restore deleted email, and it got me thinking about how vulnerable all of us are to having the ghosts of our electronic communications conjured up to haunt us. So I figured out a way to scramble email. Shred it, figuratively speaking. Now there are a number of software packages for that sort of thing. I made a hell of a lot of money off that brainstorm.
There is nothing diplomatic about my next question. Does ATF know she invented technology that might foil law enforcement efforts to restore the email of the bad guys?
Lucy replies that someone was going to come up with the technology, and the privacy of law-abiding people needs to be protected, too. ATF doesn't know about her entrepreneurial activities, or that she has been investing in internet inventions and stocks. Until this moment, only her financial advisor and Tian McGovern are privy to the fact that Lucy is a multimillionaire who has her own helicopter on order.
So that's how Tian was able to start up her own business in a prohibitively expensive city like New York, I figure.
Exactly, Lucy says. And it's why I'm not going to fight ATF, or at least one good reason. If I do battle with them, then the truth about what I've been up to on my own time would probably come out. Internal affairs, the Inspector General's office, everyone would dig. They'd find more nails to drive into my reputation as they hang me on their bureaucratic bullshit cross. Why the hell would I want to do that to myself?
If you don't fight injustice, others will suffer from it, Lucy. And maybe those people won't have millions of dollars, a helicopter, and a company in New York to fall back on as they try to start a new life.
That's exactly what the last precinct is all about, she replies. Fighting injustice. I'll fight it in my own way.
Legally, your moonlighting is not within the scope of the case it appears ATF is making against you, Lucy, the lawyer in me speaks.
Making money on the side speaks to my veracity, supposedly, though, doesn't it? She plays the other side.
Has ATF accused you of lacking veracity? Have they called you dishonest?
Well, no. That won't be in any letter from them, for sure. But truth is, Aunt Kay, I broke the rules. You aren't supposed to make money from another source while you're employed by ATF, the FBI, or any other federal law enforcement agency. I don't agree with that prohibition. It's not fair. Cops get to moonlight. We don't. Maybe I've always known my days with the feds are numbered.
She gets up from the table.
So I took care of my future. Maybe I was just sick of everything. I don't want to spend the rest of my life taking orders from other people.
If you want to leave ATF, make it your choice, not theirs.
It is my choice, she says with a trace of anger.
Guess I'd better get to the store.
I walk her to the door, arm in arm.
Thank you, I tell her. It means everything to me that you let me know.
I'm going to teach you how to fly helicopters.
She puts on her coat.
May as well, I say. I've been in a lot of unfamiliar airspace today. I guess a little more isn't going to matter.
Chapter 6. The rude joke for years has been that Virginians go to New York for art, and New York comes to Virginia for garbage. Mayor Giuliani almost started another civil war when he made that snipe during his much-publicized war with Jim Gilmore, Virginia's governor at the time, over Manhattan's right to ship megatons of northern trash to our southern landfills. I can only imagine the reaction when word gets out that now we have to go to New York for justice, too. As long as I have been the chief medical examiner of Virginia, Jamie Berger has been the head of the sex crimes unit for the district attorney's office in Manhattan. Although we have never met, we are often mentioned together. It is said that I am the most famous female forensic pathologist in the country, and she is the most famous female prosecutor. Until now, the only reaction I might have had to such a claim is that I don't want to be famous and don't trust people who are, and female should not be an adjective. Nobody talks about successful men in terms of a male doctor or male president or male CEO. Over the past few days, I have spent hours on Anna's computer researching Berger on the Internet. I resisted being impressed, but can't help it. I didn't know, for example, that she is a Rhodes Scholar, or that after Clinton was elected, she was shortlisted for Attorney General, and according to Time magazine, was privately relieved when Janet Reno was appointed instead. Berger didn't want to give up prosecuting cases. Supposedly, she has turned down judgeships and staggering offers from private law firms for the same reason, and is so admired by her peers that they established a public service scholarship in her name at Harvard, where she spent her undergraduate years. Strangely, very little is said about her personal life, except that she plays tennis. Extremely well, of course. She works out with a trainer 3 mornings a week at a New York athletic club, and runs 3 or 4 miles a day. Her favorite restaurant is Primula. I take some comfort in the fact that she likes Italian food. It is now Wednesday, early evening, and Lucy and I are Christmas shopping. I have browsed and purchased as much as I can stomach, my mind poisoned by worries, my arm itching like mad inside its plaster cocoon, my craving for tobacco akin to lust. Lucy is somewhere inside Regency Mall taking care of her own list, and I search for a spot where I might evade the churning herd. Thousands of people have waited until 3 days before Christmas to find thoughtful, special gifts for those significant people in their lives. Voices and constant motion combine in a steady roar that shorts out thoughts and normal conversation, and piped-in holiday music jars my already vibrating nerves out of phase. I face plate glass in front of Sea Dream Leather, my back to discordant people who, like unskilled fingers on a piano, rush and stop and force without joy. Pressing my cell phone tight against my ear, I yield to a new addiction. I check my voicemail for what must be the 10th time today. It has become my slender secret connection to my former existence. Tapping into my messages is the only way I can go home. There are 4 calls. Rose, my secretary, checked in to see how I am holding up. My mother left a long complaint about life. AT&T customer service tried to reach me about a billing question. And my deputy chief, Jack Fielding, needs to talk to me. I call him right away.
I can hardly hear you, his scratchy voice sounds in one ear, my hand covering the other.
In the background, one of his children is crying.
I'm not in a good place to talk, I tell him.
Me either. My ex is here. Joy to the world.
What's up? I say to him.
Some New York prosecutor just called me.
Jolted, I will myself to sound calm, almost indifferent, when I ask him this person's name. He tells me Jamie Berger reached him at home several hours ago. She wanted to know if he assisted in the autopsies I performed on Kim Luong and Diane Bray. That's interesting, I comment. Isn't your number unlisted?
Ryder gave it to her, he informs me.
Paranoia heats up. The wound of betrayal flares. Ryder gave her Jack's number and not mine?
Why didn't he tell her to call me? I ask.
Jack pauses as another child adds to the upset chorus in his house.
I don't know. I told her I didn't officially assist. You did the posts. I'm not listed on the protocols as a witness. Said she really needs to speak to you.
What was her response when you told her that? I ask.
Started asking me questions. Obviously has copies of the reports.
Ryder again. Copies of the medical examiner's initial report of investigation and the autopsy protocols go to the Commonwealth's attorney's office. I feel dizzy. It now seems that two prosecutors have spurned me, and fear and bewilderment gather like an army of fiery ants, teeming over my interior world, stinging my very psyche. What is happening is uncanny and cruel. It is beyond anything I have ever imagined in my most unsettled moments. Jack's voice sounds distant through static that seems a projection of the chaos in my mind. I make out that Berger was a very cool customer and sounded as if she was on a car phone, and then something about special prosecutors.
I thought they were only brought in for the president or Waco or whatever, he says, as the cell suddenly clears and he yells to his ex-wife, I assume. Can you take them in the other room? I'm on the phone. Jesus, he blurts out to me. Don't ever have kids.
What do you mean, special prosecutor? I inquire. What special prosecutor? Jack pauses.
I guess I'm assuming they're bringing her here to try the case because Fighter Ryder doesn't want to, he replies with sudden nervousness.
In fact, he sounds evasive. It appears they had a case in New York. I am careful what I say. That's why she's involved, or so I'm told.
You mean a case like ours?
2 years ago.
No shit. News to me. Okay. She didn't say anything about that. Just wants to know about the ones here, Jack tells me.
How many for the morning, so far? I inquire about our caseload for tomorrow.
5 so far, including a weirdo one that's going to be a pain in the butt. Young white male, maybe Hispanic, found inside a motel room. Looks like the room was torched. No ID. A needle stuck in his arm, so we don't know if he's a drug OD or smoke inhalation.
Let's not talk about it over a cell phone. I cut him off, looking around me. We'll talk about it in the morning. I'll take care of him. A long, surprised pause is followed by,
You sure? Because
I'm sure, Jack. I have not been to the office at all this week. See you then. I am supposed to meet Lucy in front of Walden Books at 7:30, and I venture back out into the churning herd. I have no sooner parked myself at the appointed spot when I notice a familiar, big, sour-looking man riding up the escalator. Marino bites into a soft pretzel and licks his fingers as he stares at the teenage girl one step above him. Her tight jeans and sweater leave no mysteries about her curves, dips, and elevations, and even from this distance I can tell Marino is mapping her routes and imagining what it would be like to travel them. I watch him carried along crowded steps of steel, heavily involved with the pretzel, chewing with his mouth open, lusting. Faded baggy blue jeans ride below his swollen gut, and his big hands look like baseball mitts protruding from the sleeves of a red NASCAR windbreaker. A NASCAR cap covers his balding head, and he wears ridiculous Elvis-size wire-rim glasses. His fleshy face is furrowed by discontent, and has the slack, flushed look of chronic dissipation, and I am startled by an awareness of how miserable he is in his own body, of how much he wars against flesh that by now fails him with a vengeance.
Marino reminds me of someone who has taken terrible care of his car, driving it hard, letting it rust and fall apart, and then violently hating it. I imagine Marino slamming down the hood and kicking the tires. We worked our first case together shortly after I moved here from Miami, and he was surly and condescending and positively boorish from the start. I was certain that by accepting the chief medical examiner's position in Virginia, I had made the biggest mistake of my life. In Miami, I had earned the respect of law enforcement and the medical and scientific community. The press treated me reasonably well, and I enjoyed a rise to minor stardom that gave me confidence and reassurance. Gender did not seem an issue until I met Peter Rocco Marino, begotten of hard-working Italian stock in New Jersey, a former New York cop, divorced from his childhood sweetheart, father of a son he never talks about. He is like the harsh lighting in dressing rooms. I was relatively comfortable with myself until I saw my reflection in him. This minute, I am unsettled enough to accept that the flaws he holds up to me are probably true. He notices me against the glass storefront, tucking my phone back into my satchel, shopping bags at my feet, and I wave at him. He takes his time maneuvering his bulk through prepossessed people who right now aren't thinking about murderers or trials or New York prosecutors. "What are you doing here?" he asks me, as if I am trespassing. "Buying your Christmas present," I say. He takes another bite of pretzel. It appears he has purchased nothing but the pretzel. "And you?" I inquire.
"Came to sit on Santa's lap and get my picture took."
"Don't let me stop you."
"I paged Lucy. She told me where in this zoo you was probably at. I thought you might need someone to carry your bags, being that you're a little short-handed at the moment. How you gonna do autopsies with that thing on?"
He indicates my cast. I know why he is here. I detect the distant roar of information headed my way like an avalanche. I sigh. Slowly but surely I am surrendering to the fact that my life is only going to get worse. "Okay, Marino. Now what?" I ask him. "What's happened now?"
"Doc, it's going to be in the paper tomorrow."
He bends over to pick up my bags.
"Ryder called me a little while ago. The DNA matches. Looks like Wolfman whacked that weather lady in New York 2 years ago, and apparently the asshole's decided he's feeling up to leaving MCV and ain't fighting extradition to the Big Apple. Just happy as a clam to get the hell out of Virginia. Kind of a weird coincidence the son of a bitch decides to leave town the same day as Bray's memorial service."
"What memorial service?" Thoughts crash into each other from all directions.
"At St. Bridget's."
I also didn't know Bray was Catholic and just happened to attend the church where I am a member. An eerie feeling tickles up into my spine. No matter what world I occupy, it seemed her mission was to break into it and eclipse me. That she might even have attempted this at my own unassuming church reminds me of how utterly ruthless and arrogant she was.
"So, Sean Dunn is transported out of Richmond on the same day we're supposed to say goodbye to the last woman he snuffed," Marino talks on, scanning every shopper bobbing past. "Don't think for a minute the timing's a coincidence. Every move he makes, the press will be there in droves. So he'll outshine Bray, steal her thunder, 'cause the media's gonna be a hell of a lot more interested in what he's doing than in who shows up to pay their respects to one of his victims. If anybody shows up to pay respects. I know I ain't. Not after all the shit she did to make my life happy. And oh yeah, Burger's on her way here even as we speak. I guess with a name like that she probably ain't into Christmas," he adds.
We spot Lucy at the same moment a gang of loud, turbulent boys do. They have the latest funky hair and cargo jeans falling off their tiny loins, and do exaggerated double takes, lusting after my niece, who is wearing black tights, scuffed army boots, and an antique flight jacket she rescued from a vintage clothing shop somewhere. Marino gives her admirers a look that would kill if glaring with hatred in one's heart could penetrate skin and perforate vital organs. The boys weave and bounce, shuffling in huge leather basketball shoes, reminding me of puppies that haven't grown into their paws yet.
"What did you buy me?" Marino asks Lucy.
"A year's supply of maca root."
"What the hell's maca root?"
"Next time you go bowling with some really hot woman, you'll appreciate my little gift," she says.
"You didn't really get him that."
I halfway believe her.
Marino snorts. Lucy laughs, seeming much too jovial for someone about to be fired, millionaire or not. Outside in the parking lot, the air is damp and very cold. Headlights dazzle the dark, and everywhere I look I find cars and people in a hurry. Silver wreaths shimmer from light posts, and drivers circle like sharks, looking for spaces close to mall entrances, as if walking several hundred feet is the worst thing that can happen to a person.
"I hate this time of year. I wish I were Jewish," Lucy ironically comments, as if she were privy to Marino's earlier allusion to Berger's ethnicity.
"Was Berger a DA when you started out in New York?" I ask him as he places my packages inside Lucy's ancient green Suburban.
"Just getting started," he shuts the tailgate. "I never met her."
"What did you hear about her?" I ask.
"Really hot-looking with big tits."
"Marino, you're so highly evolved," Lucy says.
"Hey!"
he jerks his head in parting.
"Don't ask me something if you don't want to know the answer."
I watch his shadowy bulk move through a confusion of headlights and shoppers and shadows. The sky is milky in the light of an imperfect moon, and snow drifts down in slow, small flakes. Lucy backs out of her parking place and eases into a line of cars. Dangling from her keychain is a silver medallion engraved with the logo for Whirligirls, a seemingly frivolous name for a very serious international association of female helicopter pilots. Lucy, who joins nothing, is an ardent member, and I am grateful that in spite of everything else gone wrong, at least her Christmas present is safely tucked inside one of my bags. Months ago I conspired with Schwarzschild's jewelers to have a Whirligirl's necklace made for Lucy in gold. The timing is perfect, especially in light of late-breaking revelations about her plans in life. "Just what exactly will you do with your own helicopter? You're really getting one?" I ask. In part, I want to steer the conversation away from New York and Berger. I'm still chafed by what Jack had to say over the phone, and a shadow has fallen across my psyche. Something else bothers me, and I'm not quite sure what.
"Abell 407. Yep, I'm getting it."
Lucy dips into an endless stream of red taillights flowing sluggishly along Parham Road.
"What do I plan to do with it? Fly it, that's what. And use it in the business."
"About this new business, what's next?"
"Well, Tian's living in New York, so that's where my new headquarters will be."
"Tell me more about Tian," I prompt her. "Does she have family? Where will she spend Christmas?"
Lucy stares straight ahead as she drives, always the serious pilot.
"Let me go back. Give you a little history, Aunt Kay. When she heard about the shootout in Miami, she contacted me. Then I went to New York the other week and had a rather bad time."
How well I remember. Lucy vanished, sending me into a panic. I tracked her down by phone in Greenwich Village, where she was at Ruby Fruit on Hudson, a favorite hangout in the village. Lucy was upset. She was drinking. I thought she was angry and hurt because of problems with Joe. Now the story is changing right before my eyes. Lucy has been financially involved with Tian McGovern since last summer, but it wasn't until this incident in New York last week that Lucy made the decision to change her entire life.
"Anne asks me if there's someone she can call," Lucy explains. "I wasn't exactly in a frame of mind to get myself back to my hotel."
"Anne?"
"A former cop. She owns the bar."
"Oh, that's right."
"I admit I was pretty whacked, and I told Anne to try Tian," Lucy says. "Next thing I know, Tian's walking into the bar. She pumped me full of coffee and we stayed up all night talking. Mostly about my personal situation with Joe, with ATF, with everything. I haven't been happy."
Lucy glances over at me.
"I think I've been ready for a change for a long, long time. That night I made a decision.
The decision had already been made even before this other thing happened. This other thing meaning Shandun's trying to kill me.
Thank God Tian was there for me.
Lucy doesn't mean at the bar. She is talking about McGovern's being there for her in general, and I feel happiness radiating from some space deep within Lucy's core. Common psychology dictates that other people and jobs can't make you happy. You have to make yourself happy. This is not entirely true. McGovern and the Last Precinct seem to make Lucy happy.
And you had already been involved in the Last Precinct for some time?
I encourage her to continue the story.
Since last summer? Is that when the idea first came up?
It started out as a joke in the old days in Philly, when Tian and I were driven nuts by bureaucrats with lobotomies, by people getting in the way, by watching how innocent victims get ground up in the system. We came up with this fantasy organization which I dubbed the Last Precinct. We'd say, "Where do you go when there's nowhere to go?"
Her smile is forced, and I sense that all of her upbeat news is about to get questionable shadings.
Lucy is going to tell me something I don't want to hear.
"You realize this means I need to move to New York," she says. "Soon."
Ryder has surrendered the case to New York, and now Lucy is moving to New York. I turn up the heat and pull my coat more tightly around me.
I think Tian's found me an apartment on the Upper East Side. Maybe a 5-minute jog from the park. On 67th and Lexington, she says.
That was quick, I comment. And close to where Susan Pless was murdered, I add, as if this is an ominous sign.
Why that part of town? Is Tian's office near there?
A few blocks. She's just a couple doors down from the 19th precinct. Apparently knows a bunch of NYPD guys who work that tour.
And Tian had never heard of Susan Pless, of that murder? How strange to think she ended up just several streets from there.
Negativity carries me along. I can't help it.
She knows about the murder because we've discussed what's going on with you, Lucy replies. Before that, she'd never heard of the case. Neither had I. I guess the preoccupation of our neighborhood is the East Side rapist, which is something we've gotten involved in, as a matter of fact. They've had these rapes going on for some 5 years. Same guy. Likes blondes in their 30s, early 40s. Usually they've had a few drinks, have just left a bar, and he grabs them as they're going into their apartments. New York's first John Doe DNA. We got his DNA, but not an identity.
All roads seem to lead back to Jamie Berger. The East Side rapist would most certainly be a high-priority case for her office.
I'm going to dye my hair blonde and start walking home from bars late, Lucy Riley says, and I believe she would do that.
I want to tell Lucy that the direction she has chosen is exciting, and I am thrilled for her, but the words won't come. She has lived many places that aren't close to Richmond, but for some reason this time it feels as if she is finally leaving home for good, that she is grown. Suddenly I become my mother, criticizing, pointing out the downside, the deficits, lifting up the rug to look for that one spot I missed when I cleaned the house, reviewing my report card of straight A's, and commenting what a shame it is I have no friends, tasting what I cook, and finding it lacking.
"What will you do with your helicopter? Will you keep it up there?" I hear myself say to my niece. "Seems like that will be a problem."
"Probably Teterboro."
"So you'll have to go all the way into New Jersey when you want to fly?"
"It's not that far."
"The cost of living up there, too. And you and Tian?" I hammer away.
"What about me and Tian?"
The lift has left Lucy's voice.
"Why do you keep picking on that?"
Anger rolls in.
"I don't work for her anymore. She's not ATF or my supervisor anymore. There's nothing wrong with us being friends."
My fingerprints are all over the crime scene of her disappointment, her hurt. Even worse, the echoes of Dorothy are in my voice. I'm ashamed of myself, deeply ashamed.
"Lucy, I'm sorry." I reach over and take her hand in the fingertips of my plaster-confined one.
"I don't want you to leave. I'm feeling selfish. I'm being selfish. I'm sorry."
"I'm not leaving you.
I'll be in and out. Only 2 hours away by chopper. It's all right. She looks at me. Why don't you come work with us, Aunt Kay?
She is out with what I can tell is not a new thought. Obviously, she and McGovern have discussed quite a lot about me, including my possible role in their company. This realization gives me a peculiar sensation. I have resisted contemplating my future, and suddenly it rises before me like a great blank screen. While I know in my mind that the way I have lived my life is in the past, I have yet to accept this truth in my heart.
Why don't you go into business for yourself instead of the state telling you what to do? Lucy goes on. Have you ever given serious thought to that?
It's always been the plan for later on, I reply.
Well, later on is here, she tells me. The 20th century ends in exactly 9 days.
Chapter 7. It is almost midnight. I sit before the fire in the hand-carved rocker that is the only hint of rusticity in Anna's house. She has set her chair at a deliberate angle so she can look at me, but I don't have to look at her if I find myself in sensitive discovery of my own psychological evidence. I have learned of late that I never know what I might find during my conversations with Anna, as if I am a crime scene I am searching for the first time. The lights are switched off in the living room, the fire in its agonal stages of going out. Incandescence spreads along smoldering coals that breathe shades of orange, as I tell Anna about a Sunday night in November a little over a year ago, when Benton got uncharacteristically hateful toward me.
When you say uncharacteristically, you mean what? Anna asks in her strong, quiet tone.
He was accustomed to my peregrinations late at night when I couldn't settle down, when I would stay up late and work. On the night in question, he fell asleep while reading in bed. Not unusual, and it was my cue that I could have my own time now. I craved the silence, the absolute aloneness when the rest of the world is unconscious and not needing something from me.
You always have felt this need?
Always, I tell her. It's when I come alive. I come into myself when I'm absolutely alone. I need the time. I must have it.
What happened on the night you mention? She asks.
I got up and took the book out of his lap, turned out the light, I reply.
What was he reading?
Her question catches me by surprise. I have to think. I don't remember clearly, but I seem to recall Benton was reading about Jamestown, the first permanent English settlement in America that is less than an hour's drive east of Richmond. He was very interested in history, and had double majored in it and psychology in college, and then his curiosity about Jamestown was ignited when archaeologists began excavating out there and discovered the original fort. It slowly comes back to me. The book Benton was reading in bed was a collection of narratives, many of them written by John Smith. I don't recall the title, I tell Anna. I suppose the book is still in my house somewhere, and the idea of happening upon it one of these days pains me. I go on with my story. I left the bedroom and quietly shut the door and went down the hall to my office, I say. As you know, when I do autopsies, I take sections of every organ and sometimes of wounds as well. The tissue goes to the histology lab, where it's made into slides I must review. I can never keep up with micro-dictations and routinely take slide folders home, and of course the police ask me all about this. It's funny, but my normal activities seem mundane and beyond question until they are inspected by others. That's when I realize I don't live like other people.
Why do you think the police wanted to know about slides you might have in your house? Anna asks.
Because they wanted to know about everything. I go back to my story about Benton, describing being in my office, bent over my microscope, lost in heavy, metal-stained neurons that looked like a swarm of one-eyed purple and gold creatures with tentacles. I felt a presence behind me, and turned to find Benton standing in my open doorway, his face filled with an eerie, ominous glow, like St. Elmo's fire before lightning strikes.
"Can't sleep?" he asked me in a mean, sarcastic tone that didn't sound like him. I pushed my chair back from my powerful Nikon microscope.
"If you could teach that thing to fuck, you wouldn't need me at all," he said, and his eyes flew at me with the bright fury of the cells I was looking at.
Dressed in pajama bottoms, Benton was pale in the partial light spreading out from the lamp on my desk, his chest heaving and shiny with sweat, veins roping in his arms, his silver hair plastered to his forehead. I asked him what in the world was the matter, and he ordered me back to bed, jabbing his finger at me. At this point, Anna interrupts me. "Nothing else might have preceded this? No forewarning whatsoever?" She knew Benton, too. This wasn't Benton. This was an alien who had invaded Benton's body. "Nothing," I answer her. "No warning." I rock slowly, non-stop. Smoldering wood pops. The last place I wanted to be with him that moment was in bed. He may have been the FBI's star psychological profiler, but for all of his prowess at reading others, he could be as cold and uncommunicative as a stone. I had no intention of staring up at the dark all night while he lay with his back to me, mute, hardly breathing. But what he wasn't was violent or cruel. He had never talked to me in such a demeaning, abusive way. If we had nothing else, Anna, we had respect. We always treated each other with respect.
"And did he tell you what was wrong?"
She presses me on this. I smile bitterly. When he made the crude comment about teaching my microscope to fuck, that told me. Benton and I had grown comfortable living in my house, yet he never stopped feeling like a guest. It is my house, and everything about it is me. The last year of his life he was disillusioned with his career, and as I look back on it now, he was tired and without purpose and feared getting old. All of it eroded our intimacy. The sexual part of our relationship became an abandoned airport that looked normal from a distance, but no one was in the tower. No landings, no takeoffs, only an occasional touch and go because we thought we should, because of the accessibility and old habit, I guess.
"When you did have sex, who usually initiated it?" Anna asks.
"Eventually, just him. More out of desperation than desire. Maybe even frustration." "Yes, frustration," I decide. Anna watches me, her face in shadows that deepen as the fire dies. Her elbow is propped on the armrest, her chin resting on her index finger in what has become the pose I associate with our intense time together these past few nights. Her living room has become a dark confessional booth where I can be emotionally newborn and naked and feel no shame. I don't see our sessions as therapy, but rather as a priesthood of friendship that is sacred and safe. I have begun to tell another human being what it is like to be me.
"Let's go back to